California. Dr. Alcohol.
Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm the adult husband of a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I'm also a mild alcoholic. A marvelous introduction. A little short, but yeah, everybody disappeared. This is tremendous. Just tremendous. We were saying last night that I love. AA functions where there are too many people for the size of the room. Alcoholics jammed into a room set off an energy that drives fire marshals crazy. But but I love it. And I always have a feeling of discomfort for the people that have to stand. And then I realized, what the hell, I've got to stand. But there are seats, you can sit on the steps if you want to come up here, but of course you're too, you want to come up to the front of the room. It's hard to get out if you don't like to talk when you're sitting up there. I'm certainly convinced that being an alcoholic in Texas and in Fort Worth and in the Legacy Group, it must be extremely easy to stay sober. Jeez, I can't imagine anybody having any problems amidst all this love and energy. It's just terrific. It's been a wonderful weekend for us. I just loved it. And matter of fact, talking about the crowd and the group, I was on the mail last night, and it seems to me that alcoholics are like honeybees. I read someplace that if you see a honeybee, there's no such thing as a honeybee. If you see a honeybee, you know there has to be a hive of bees nearby. Bees take other bees to live with. They have to live in a hive together because certain ones do certain things that they can't all do at all. And the honeybee can't live by itself. It has to live as part of a hive. And I think it's pretty much that way with alcoholics. We we need other honeybees. It reminds me of many years ago, Max decided to buy a lot up in an orange grove. And I thought it was one of the dumbest suggestions ever. It turned out that that's where we built our house, and we lived there for 21 years. But at the time, it was just an orange grove, and it was we went out to see it, and for some unknown reason, we took a fellow, Ernie Fredder was his name. Ernie went with us, and Ernie was a salesman, the kind of salesman who likes to tell jokes. He's always talking, always telling jokes, and he went with us, and I don't know why, and he kept, and there was a row of eucalyptus trees, and a lot of crows there in this orchard and these eucalyptus trees, and we were standing there trying to figure out if it was a corner lot, where would it be, if there was streets, if the streets were there, which weren't there. And we're trying to figure this out, and Ernie is trying to talk to us about these goddamn crows. And I really didn't want to know anything about crows. I wanted to know where my lot was, this stupid lot that my dumb wife had decided to buy. And I had my own problems and didn't want to know about crows. And he was real fascinated because crows are so smart. He was telling me how smart crows are. He says, crows can talk to each other, he says. They can talk to each other. And I didn't pay much attention to him. And he says, well, you do know that crows, if you take crows from one part of the country and you mix them with crows from another part of the country, they can't understand each other. They have their own provincial language. And I still didn't give a darn about his dumb crow. And I was still trying to figure out what the lot was. And he said, did you know that crows won't fly across an open field? If there's a flock of crows flying along and they come to an open field, they'll stop and they'll send one crow out. And if that crow gets shot down, they'll know there's a hunter there. And I started to laugh, and I said, well, hell, no wonder crows are so smart. All the dummies get shot down. So, I guess the moral of the story is, if you're flying along and you notice to the right and left you're all by yourself, and you look down and see an open field, you better fly to the nearest phone booth and call your sponsor. You may be about to get shot down and be a dumb crow instead of an old crow. Anyhow, I'm sure there are no old dumb crows here. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. We've had a wonderful weekend. It's been just terrific. I've really enjoyed this so much. And a number of people have asked me, how long I sober, how old I am, how the story get in the book. And I don't talk about it, the story in the book, but Ted mentioned it before. I guess the reason is I feel embarrassed in the sense that, I don't know, I just guess I feel embarrassed, but I'm not embarrassed in talking about it to you. It's as though, part of the embarrassment comes from the fact that I had nothing to do with it. I thought that putting my story in the book was just about as brilliant an idea as me coming to AA in the first place. Well, it really wasn't funny. I came to AA by mistake. I was not meant to be here. But the same way with the story. It's only a matter of a month or two, well, maybe a couple or 3 months by now, that I was looking through a file of correspondence that I had with the Grapevine, because I had sent 8 or 10 articles into the Grapevine over the first few years. And in writing back about one of them, the one called No Pills to Alcoholics, it was an article on why alcoholics shouldn't take pills or what pills they could or couldn't take. And they wrote back, and the editor of the Grapevine asked me if by chance I had had a dual problem, meaning I had a problem with both chemicals as well as alcohol, and would I be interested in writing my story up or something. Well, I thought that was such a dumb idea that I didn't even answer the letter. And some months later, she called from New York and asked me if I'd ever written my story up, and I said, of course not. And she said, would I be willing to write it up and submit it to the committee with review stories for possible inclusion in the next edition of the book? And I said, of course not. And she said, well, she'd like for him to do it. And because then I realized, or I was educated to the fact, and a lot of people don't realize it, that this is the third edition of the book, and in each edition, the first 164 pages do not change. Our program stays the same. But in the second and then in the third edition, they took some stories out and put some other stories in. And I have no idea how they decide what ones they're going to put in or what ones they're going to take out. But she asked if I'd send it in. They gave me a deadline to do it. I said I didn't think I'd have time to do it. And she said, well, do your best. Try to get it in. I let the deadline pass and thought that'd be the end of it. And she called again and wanted to know where it was. I said, I hadn't written it. And she said, I'll extend the deadline. And a gal named Julie that worked for me in the office along with Max, she is a medical transcriptionist, a professional typist. She thought it would be great to have typed the story, which ended up in the book. And she says, if you write the story, I'll type it. We'll send it in. And I wrote it, and she typed it. And we sent it in. And they wrote back and said, we couldn't wait for it. We had to have another printing. And so they had another printing instead of a new edition. And I thought, that's fine. That'll be the end of that. She said, no, we'll put it in the grapevine. So they put it in the grapevine, exactly as it was written, except that they took out one word, which I thought was one of the best words in the thing. They took out the word Al-Anonism. That's what Stacy was talking about this afternoon. She said she didn't like the idea of people calling spouses of alcoholics Al-Anons if indeed they never don't go to Al-Anon and don't go to meetings and don't do the Al-Anon steps and work the program. And the reason for that is, Stacy, she didn't say it, but you know, we alcoholics have a very strange disease that even the medical profession, most of them don't understand. It's a very strange disease, but it's called alcoholism. And the Al-Anons, their disease is so strange that nobody's even thought of a name for it yet. And so I was going to call it Al-Anonism, and they took it out of the story. But I love Al-Anon. I go regularly, and as a matter of fact, I think every alcoholic ought to have an Al-Anon. At least one, you know. They need somebody to help them take their inventory and things like that. You shouldn't laugh at the Al-Anons. You should never laugh at the Al-Anons. Our book speaks very kindly of them, says they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. But don't laugh at the Al-Anons. There is one fault with them, though. But I don't think they appreciate. I really don't think the Al-Anons appreciate how hard we worked to make them what they are today. They need to be reminded of it. I tell Max every so often, my God, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't even be an Al-Anon. She stands up real straight and says, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't even need Al-Anon. And anyhow, they took that word out. And they put it in the grapevine. And in the grapevine, they put it under the title that I had sent it in under, Bronze Moccasins. And even on the front of the grapevine, they had a cartoon of a pair of moccasins. And then, later on, when they did put out the third edition of the book, they changed the title to what it is today, Doctor, Addict, Alcoholic. And as far as my guess is, you know, I don't know any this. All I'm just guessing at why this all happened, because they didn't even let me know they were going to put out a new edition and put the story in. In fact, the central office called up and said to Max, does Doctor know his story is in the new third edition of the book? And she said, no, we didn't know that. And hell, I already had a book. I had to go out and buy another one. And I had two books, for God's sake. But in the grapevine, you send an article in the grapevine, they'll send you an advanced copy a month ahead of time. You get a free copy of the grapevine. I had to go and buy another one. Anyway, and they changed the title, as they say. And that's the only thing I can figure out, that they wanted one that it could be a professional and have both alcohol and addiction. And being an addict doesn't make you not an alcoholic. On the other hand, I don't think if you're not an alcoholic, having some other problem doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I think that was the point they were trying to make. And that's how the thing got in there. And that was, so the people that asked me, did I know Bill W. and all those, no, I don't go back quite that far. I go back that far with Max. Max was talking this afternoon, too. It's a good thing not all of you were there to hear that. grossly exaggerated. I I forget what I was talking about. Was anybody listening? Did anybody know where I was? I didn't know. Having talked about that, I really am lost.
Did you get your free copy?
I didn't get my free copy. That's right. I had to go out and buy another book. And I did that with the grapevine. But that doesn't help. I'm sorry. Somebody try something else. But the point about me being sent to AA, and you're laughing about that, that really wasn't funny at all, because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was, through a series of mistakes and misunderstandings, I was accidentally a patient on the nut ward in the hospital I was on the staff of. I had a brain tumor. There's nothing funny about a brain tumor. I was there by mistake, and they missed it completely. And not only did they miss it, but they had a weird idea on the nut ward that they tried to convince me that the quality of my life would improve if I learned how to make leather belts. I didn't see how my life would be improved in any way for me to know how to make leather belts. And I didn't understand the instructions. And I have no idea why. I could tell, though, when this psychiatrist asked me about going to AA, what he did is he asked would I like to talk to a man from AA. I remember I was sitting there thinking of all the problems and mistakes and misunderstandings and all the goofy things that had happened in my life, and I deteriorated to that point where I was there in that hospital. And he walked up to me and said, would I be willing to talk to a man from AA? And I thought, God almighty, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? Didn't even like alcoholics, for God's sake. I didn't know how to treat alcoholics. But I could tell by the look on his face. I could just tell. I felt kind of guilty that I could read him that well. I could just tell by the look on his face that he'd be happy if I said yes. And I don't know if you know it, but I'm sure none of you have ever been on a nut ward. But if you ever are, for a chance, you'll find that happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. It's nice to have a happy psychiatrist. And I went off to one of these AA meetings, and he really got interested in me. They paid a lot of attention. Talked to me, wondered what they did, what they said, what went on, what it was like, when was I going again. And I thought, oh my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. And he's sending me to meetings because he's ashamed to go. And I wondered how many meetings I'd have to go to before I'd get him sober. You know, it's a funny thing. It's a part of the power of this program. I'm always impressed with the power of this program. Turned out, I found out later that he's not an alcoholic. A psychiatrist, not an alcoholic. He's still in practice there in Santa Ana, California. And he... But when he was in an internship, when you're to do a month in each psychiatry, obstetrics, medicine, surgery, dermatology, and so on, the month that he went through psychiatry, he had to go to two AA meetings, open AA meetings, just to see what AA was like, to round out his training in psychiatry. And he was so impressed. He was so impressed with what he saw at those two AA meetings that now, many years later, that's his favorite deal as a psychiatrist, to run around with this butterfly net and capture alcoholics, you know. And he'd send them off to AA. And he won't even treat them until they're sober a couple of years. Then if they're still flaky enough, then he may treat them, but he won't try to do for them what he thinks AA can do better. And the thing I was starting to think was, one year, a few years back, I was at an IDAA meeting, International Doctors in AA, an organization for doctors that are sober in AA. And there was a panel, I was on a panel with four other doctors. And of the four of us, three of us doctors had been captured by this one psychiatrist. and had been sentenced to AA. And the fourth one of us had been captured by one of the three of us. And all four of us at that time were working full-time in the field of alcoholism, chemical dependency. So just think over the years, how many alcoholics, the ripple effect of how many alcoholics have been helped by that two AA meetings that one non-alcoholic psychiatrist went to. Somehow that really impresses me. And a different kind of story of that type, though, the power of this program. At our home group, we, on Wednesday night, Laguna Beach, every year you put down there, somebody said to me last night, they said, where are you from? I said, Laguna Niguel. He looked at me kind of blank. I says, it's near Laguna Beach. He looked at me kind of blank. I says, it's on a coast from Mission Viejo. He looked at me kind of blank. I says, it's about halfway between San Diego and Los Angeles. He says, oh, California. Anyhow, if you ever get out to California, Southern California, near the coast, in Laguna Beach, give us a call. My Wednesday night home group, we give cakes, birthday cakes, every Wednesday night. Not too many months ago, a young woman got up to get her cake. And she said that, our meeting, the Laguna Beach speakers meeting of AA is held in the Laguna Beach Women's Club, which is just up the hill, a short block, a little longer than that, but still short, a short block from Albertson's Market. She said 15 years ago, that night, she had been down in Albertson's supermarket, had bought a half pint of booze, and when she went to pay for it, she asked if she could use the women's restroom. And in the restroom, she cracked the bottle and had her drink. And as she left the supermarket, she started walking up the short block past the Laguna Beach Women's Club. Our meeting hadn't started yet, and some of us were out on the street. We invited her in, and 15 years later, she'd never had another drink. Isn't that powerful? Isn't that powerful? I almost cry when I think of that story. It's just an amazing thing that we, and really a powerful thing we deal with here. Anyway, I wasn't even an alcoholic, like I say, when I was sent to the... I wasn't, and in fact, I have no idea why going to AA. See, originally, there are two kinds of people in AA. There are those who want the very minimum, the least they can get of this thing, and still somehow get by. And there are people like you see in the legacy group where they want all they can get and more, you know. Today I want all I can get of this thing. I'm like the gal. I didn't hear her say it, but somebody told me that the gal had said that she used to drink for the fun of it. And she had so much fun drinking that she drank until drinking got to be a habit. And she continued to drink until she had to drink. In fact, it got so bad she had to go to AA. And she went because she had to until it got to be a habit. Now she goes for the fun of it. It's kind of that sort of thing. As a matter of fact, I remember when I first got sober, I remember calling Chuck C. one night, and I said, they always tell us, stick with the winners. I said, well, that's fine. What's a winner? And I called Chuck. I says, what's a winner? And he had thought for a minute. He says, well, I guess you have to die sober. I said, well, that's fine. You die sober, you're a winner. And I used that for a while, but I got to thinking, maybe it'd be better to just live sober. And then I got the idea that I'd like to be a successful member of AA. That was my goal, to be a successful member of AA. And over the years, my definition of success has varied a little bit. But essentially, I want to be a successful member of AA. More recently, I've been in the thing where I want to get, I don't know how much time I got left, but in whatever time, I'm sure there's a lot of time left, but whatever time there is, I want to get everything I can out of this program. I'm just trying to get everything I can out of this program. It's a lot there. I want it all. I want as much as I can get. And so I'm more into that category. But of all the things I've been to in AA, of all this variety of things, functions and so on, I've never been to an AA function where they had a occupational therapy booth. And I don't know why you'd have thought there'd have to be an occupational therapy booth, because I went back to that hospital and I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. Pair of moccasins and a half a wallet. And I just love those moccasins. They looked good, they felt good, they wore good. It took 7 years. They would tongs to break, I'd repair them. 7 years it took before those moccasins wore out to the point where I couldn't repair them anymore. And I felt bad. Not bad enough to go back and make another pair. Now, I guess Max was afraid that I might. And so for my 7th AA birthday, my dear Al-Anon wife had my moccasins bronzed. And I love my bronze moccasins. I figure as long as I remember where they came from, I won't have to go back and make another pair. And I just love them, even though they're not nearly as comfortable anymore. You'll be happy to know that I just remembered what it was I was thinking of when I forgot what I was thinking of. Ordinarily, it's your loss, because I think of it on the way home, you know. I was thinking, I don't know how it was that we were talking about duration and time with Max. Max, we were thinking of age and that. I was talking about how long I'd been sober and about the history of the thing being in the book. And people have been asking me how old I am. They want to know how old Max is, but they won't ask her. They say, how old is Paul? I'll be 72 in November. And Max and I have been emotionally involved with each other since 4 years of age. And we've been married 50 years since last December. And that's AA. You're applauding AA and Al-Anon. And it's interesting to me that we can, the program can do that to the two of us, because she drove me to drink for years. It's amazing how the change in both of us, especially her. In fact, what we have now, it's like I was talking about Chuck C. It's kind of like Elsa C. says, when you have two people on the program and they're both growing, because if people on the program, if they're not both growing, they don't grow together, they're going to grow apart. This way. And even then, you grow in fits and starts, so you feel like you're apart a lot of the time. And you got to hang in there until they catch up to you. And worse than that is if you're the one down here. But if you grow together, even in spite of the fits and starts, like Elsa C. says, it's like two railroad tracks, separately but together, with all those meetings and all the program holding you together. And it's a great way to go, great way to go. That's what I was thinking about that left my mind. Also, when I was sitting here, they were kidding me about autographing Paul O. And autographing all these cards about being famous and being a celebrity. They're all making me, what they're doing is BSing me is what they were doing. Just like Ted was up here when he's introducing me. It reminded me of, I've always wanted to be famous. In fact, I don't like to travel. I just don't like to travel. Max likes to travel. I don't like to travel. But I always had visions that at the appropriate time, I would be willing to go to Sweden or Norway or wherever it is, where the king gives out the Nobel Prize in medicine. I would have discovered a cure for cancer, high blood pressure, common cold. And then when I got over there and got the Nobel Prize in medicine, I would make God famous by saying, God did it. Remember the movie Amadeus, where Salieri, all he wanted was for God to make him famous. He was willing to work hard. He was a good musician. He was willing to do all that stuff. And God didn't make him famous. He made this jerky little Mozart famous. It drove Salieri crazy. He tried to kill himself. He was really ticked off at God. Well, I didn't identify with Mozart. I identified with Salieri. And because I, too, wanted God to see. All he had to do was tell me a few little scientific facts, like the cause of cancer, high blood pressure, I don't know. And give me the facts. I would publish it and be famous, and I would say that he did it. I was going to make God famous. And all he had to do was make me famous first. I thought it was real. That would be easy for him to do. And I thought it was a real bargain, but he never bought it. He not only didn't make me famous, he made me anonymous. The point was, as I said, I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. And I wasn't. And I thought you got alcoholism by drinking. And that's not true. You don't get alcoholism from drinking. You get drunk from drinking. But you get alcoholism by associating with alcoholics. It's a contagious disease. It's a virus. And it's a virus, and it affects your brain. You know, it goes in through your ears. And you have to be careful what you listen to when you're around alcoholics. But that's how they give it to you. You hear them say, well, they did something, and you say, gee, I did something like that. I felt like that when I did that. You suppose I might be an alcoholic? Boom, just like that, you're an alcoholic. You become an alcoholic in an instant. We're instant alcoholics. You know? And the bad part about it is, once you got it, you can't get rid of it. I thought I'd get rid of it by giving it to somebody else. I didn't want it. You know? And that made it worse. The more I gave it away, the more I had it. You know? I'm a much, much, much worse alcoholic tonight than I was then. When I first became an alcoholic, I was very mild, just a little bit. Hardly alcoholic at all. In fact, I was allergic to alcohol. That's what in AA they say: allergy to the body and compulsion to the mind. Allergy to the body and compulsion to the mind. That's what they say: allergy to the body and compulsion to the mind. I didn't have that. I had mild allergy, but I didn't have any compulsion. When I wanted a drink, I took it. What would happen if you waited for a compulsion and it didn't show up? But I did have an allergy. I had an allergy. And I had an allergy to alcohol, but I wasn't a drunkard. I wasn't a wino, I wasn't a lush, I certainly wasn't a skid row bum. There was a whole lot of things I wasn't, but I had an alcohol allergy. I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. I do weird, and alcohol affects me weirdly. Drinking alcohol makes me thirsty. Normal drinker, they feel thirsty, take a little drink. Hell, they might not even finish the dumb thing. You know? Waste it. And when I have a drink of alcohol, it makes me thirsty. Every drink tastes like one more drink. In fact, my last drink is way in the back of my brain there someplace, ready to tell me, come on, you need another drink. And I know it's there. It's following me. I have a disease, and it's following me. All I don't know is how far back it is. And I could find out by going to meetings and wait till it got, I needed one more meeting and when I get drunk. I'm not that curious. All I need to know, I'm glad that it's there. I'm glad to know it'll always be there. It'll always be suggesting that I need a drink. but it isn't a compulsion. But I react peculiar to alcohol when I drink it. I don't feel all that wonderful when I drink. Some people feel wonderful when they drink it. I didn't feel wonderful. Every drink I took seemed like a good idea. Seemed like a good idea at the time. But I did react peculiarly. I would have a few drinks and it might relax me too much or something. It'd be like might affect my tongue, and I would have to talk slowly and deliberately, so nobody would notice. Or I would reach for something and knock it over, or I would trip when there was nothing to trip. I might even find myself lying there, looking very serene. And I think, get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk. And my mind would say, what do you mean, get up? We're paralyzed from the ears down. I think, isn't that strange that I can't move? I never heard of anybody that when they drank, they got paralyzed from the ears down. I must have an idiosyncrasy to alcohol. I have an abnormal response to this medication. I have a peculiar response to this drug, this medicine. And I have an allergy. I'll have to ask somebody about that sometime. I was in medical school at the time, it was back a little ways. I thought in medical school, and I think, I'd ask some allergy professor or something sometime. But I never found anybody to ask. You can't ask just anybody a question like that. They're very prone to say, I don't know, but if it affects me that way, I just wouldn't drink it anymore. I didn't ask anybody, but I could lie there on the floor and visually I'd be leafing through the pages to Goodman and Gilman's textbook of pharmacology under alcohol and blood levels and looking for paralysis from the ears down. And I never found it. I never found it, but it was good. Being a scientific bent, it kept my mind on my paralysis and it took my mind off my full bladder. And it really wasn't very funny. There's nothing funny about having a full bladder and a paralysis from the ears down and a bladder that's full and refuses to remain full. very impractical. And the bad part about that is that AA has not been any help to me on my limited bladder capacity. I have to be very careful. You can't AA coffee. I'm drinking water. AA coffee is as bad as beer was as far as bladder. You identify him. Yeah, my bladder capacity. But I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining because even though my capacity is no better, my aim is a whole lot better. I like that. I like that. And Max likes that too. And I kept going to meetings and I turned into an alcoholic. And then I realized that in AA they have two kinds of people in AA, those that are still drinking and those that aren't. And the ones that aren't drinking are the ones that seem to be having all the fun. And I thought I'd like to be one of the non-drinking kind. And so I started looking around to see who the winners were and how they were staying sober, and I decided I better not drink. And one of the things was that I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. Before that, I had said that. I admitted it. I admitted I was an alcoholic. They liked that in AA. You notice that here tonight, newcomers say, they love that. I said, you're an alcoholic. Oh, isn't it wonderful? And clap, clap, clap. Yeah. It really turns them on here. So I did that. I said, my name's Paul. And I said, oh, boy, they were real happy. You know, anything to please them, you know. I admitted it, even though it wasn't true. But then when I accepted it, that made a difference. But I noticed that they don't have you drink. They don't like for you to drink in AA. They don't tell you that, but you can tell. You notice that, newcomers? They didn't say to you, don't you drink now. There's none of that, but boy, you can tell. They don't like the drinking program. It's really a non-drinking program. So I figured I got to quit drinking, but I was afraid to quit drinking because I've quit drinking many, 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 many times. And every time I quit drinking, I ended up drunk. And now here I am. I'm a drinking alcoholic, and I can't quit because I'll get drunk. And didn't know what to do and didn't want to ask anybody. When you're a doctor, you don't ask people. And I heard some of the dumb things they said in AA. They said a lot of dumb things. I remember the time the guy said, if I don't drink today, I'm a success today. And I said, oh, God, what kind of an organization is this where they brag about not having a lousy beer, for God's sake? And then this thing that Ted says, if you don't drink today, you won't get drunk today. Now, any damn fool knows that. You don't, and you might tell that to a Skid Row bum or something, but you don't tell that to a doctor, for God's sake. If you don't drink today, you won't get drunk today. I thought, well, I don't know what else to do, so I thought, I just won't tell anybody. I won't say anything to anybody. I just won't drink today and see what happens. Nothing happened. I decided to try it another day. Nothing happened that day. And I've been doing that for 22 years. That and a few other things. This is a very important date to me. Today's the day I don't drink. I never drink on Saturdays. I drank many yesterday. I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. And in fact, I don't know for sure. Maybe I couldn't even keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. But when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time. And if it's today, I won't drink today. And I haven't been drunk since the last time I quit drinking. There you go. So it's worked well for me. That and a few other things, having a sponsor. And somebody asked me who my sponsor was, and a guy named Jack N. He and I used to go to meetings together. He and his wife and Max and I go to meetings together. And he was a month or two longer in the program than I was. And one night the men's stag meeting was jumping on me because I didn't have a sponsor when I was whining about something Max had done. And I was telling him about it, so I said, what about you? Why don't you be my sponsor? And he said, well, I'll be your sponsor if you'll be my sponsor. So we've been sponsoring each other ever since. Short time later, he had a one-night testing to see if they were making alcohol different than they were. I love the research workers in AA. God bless them. And don't ever... we need them. We need the research work. And he found out it didn't work, so he came back. So now I'm a couple of months ahead of him. But we sponsor each other, so we call each other twice as often. He's a great guy. Great guy. He's a great guy, except he has this real dumb expression. No matter what your problem is, no matter what you're complaining about, he says, well, whatever. What am I supposed to do with, well, whatever? When he's describing his problems and all the trouble he's going through, and he can end up saying, well, whatever, I tell Max, boy, doesn't Jack work a wonderful program, doesn't he? I've told the story many times, but I used to think that I would have done much more with my life if things had been different. Circumstances screwed it up, and my life would have been so much different if there had been more crime. My father hadn't been in Alliance, Ohio. He'd been in a big town like Fort Worth, and he hadn't been a doctor instead of a druggist, and Max had been more cooperative, and we hadn't adopted those two girls, and especially if Max would act differently. You know? And somebody ought to know, what it's like to live with Max, so that they understand why I haven't done more with my life than I have. And I would call him up. Somebody ought to know, and I would call him up. That's what it was like living with Max. And I called him up one time when she had done something really horrendous that I can't recall at the moment. And I'd hardly even got started in telling him what things she had done, and he interrupted me. He says, "Why don't you put it out of your mind for a couple of days and see what happens?" I said, "Jack, couple of days, I'll forget all about it." You know? And that's the big problem with problems. That's the problem with problems. Problems have a very high infant mortality. You can't neglect problems for any length of time at all because they just wither and die. I mean, that's why it's such a dangerous thing to have somebody call you on the phone when you're right in the midst of working on a problem. You know? "Well, wait, I'll talk to you as soon as I'm right down where I am in this problem. I don't want to lose my place, you know." I get onto the phone, and by the time I get back, the problem is withered and died. And you can't neglect problems. You've got to stay right with them. I don't even have to work on a problem to watch it grow. I just have to think about it. I can take any little old problem, and it puts waters it, fertilizes it, and allows it to grow. I take any little problem and just think about it a little bit. In fact, I can take a non-problem. Hell, that's no problem. No, I suppose if you think about it enough, it could be a little bit of a problem. Pretty soon I'm thinking, "By God, this is kind of interesting." And pretty soon I think, "My God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. Everybody else is missing it." You know, and this gets bigger and bigger and bigger. People can't even help you much with a problem like that. They tell you dumb things. "Well, don't think about it." How are you going to not think about something you're obsessed with? You know? I don't even bother with problems unless they're worth getting obsessed with. Like resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. And I always love to tell you why it's justifiable. My sponsor says to me, Paul says, "Don't drink and don't think." All my problems today are thinking problems. I don't even have a problem today unless I think I do. And conversely, I've never ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. So I think I got a problem, I got a problem. And no matter what you think, if I think I got a big problem, it's a big problem. If I think it's a little problem, it's a little problem. And if I don't think I have a problem, I don't have a problem, no matter what anybody else thinks. I determine whether or not I have a problem and the size of my problems. I just love my problems. They all come from my thinking. I have, in a talking, and I don't know how you think, but I think with somebody talking to me. Somebody in my head is talking to me. In fact, a lot of times people think I'm not listening to them, and I am, but I'm also listening to the voice in my head that's telling me what to say as soon as you stop talking. And sometimes there's more than one. They're arguing with me as to what and they even get to fighting among themselves as to what they're going to tell me when you stop talking. That's how my head is all the time. Somebody talk. And if I do get to drinking a lot of coffee and get a lot of caffeine, and they really get wired up and talk. And after the midnight, I go home, I want to go lie down, and my body wants to go to sleep. My brain says, "No, let's lay here and talk about it a while." Yeah. In fact, a lot of times I'll get to sleep, and at 2:30, 3, 3 o'clock in the morning, they'll say, "Hey, wake up, we've had a meeting. This is an emergency, we need to talk to you." You know that thing that went on today that you thought went so well and they're so happy with you about? Wasn't like that at all. Yeah. They're really ticked off at you. Wait till morning, you'll find out. I don't want to listen to that crap. And I'll roll over and go back to sleep. And just as I'm about to lose consciousness, I'll think to myself, "Boy, I'm glad I'm not thinking about that anymore." And I say, "Hey, you know, that's not the only time you did that. You about 6 months ago you did. As a matter of fact, you've done a lot of dumb. Let's spend the rest of the night making lists of dumb things that you've done. You know, you don't want to write your fourth? By God, we'll write it tonight." You know, and they just love to think of dumb things that I've done throughout my life. And that's the way that goes. And anyhow, here we go. I better shut up and sit down. That's what I. I admitted I was an alcoholic, even though it wasn't true. I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink since. And today I approve of the fact that I'm an alcoholic. Acceptance is not approval. And that's a tricky thing, because we are taught, if you look it up in the dictionary, and look up the word acceptance, and it'll tell you that you accept receipt of something that you approve of. If you're buying merchandise, if you don't like the merchandise, you don't accept it. If they've already delivered it, you've accepted it, you don't like it, you return it. And they apologize and take it back, or more or less, take it back. But you don't accept things unless you approve of them. But that's in the outside world. But we live in two worlds. There's the world outside my head and the world inside my head. And in that world, approval has absolutely nothing to do with it. Life is... Somebody sent me a cartoon. Not a cartoon, a poster. Said, "Life is, and we have thoughts about it." And, you know, we decide whether we like life or not, and it really matters. It doesn't matter at all whether we approve, because there's nobody to complain to. Nobody but God himself. And I can't imagine any angel running to God and saying, "Hey, Paul doesn't approve what you just did." And I certainly can't imagine God saying, "Oh my God, we can't stand that. Go down and change it." You know, the customer is not always right when God's doing it. He really doesn't care, I guess. I don't know. But I had the feeling that someday that it'll all make sense when I can see the whole big picture. But he doesn't have to have it make sense to me in order to allow it to be that way today. As a matter of fact, I remember one day I flicked on the radio or TV, Robert Schuller was talking, and he said that the question of why. Robert Schuller said that when people ask God why, they don't want a reason, they want an argument. And essentially, a pact of why is an impediment to my happiness. Because I'm saying, if you'll explain to me why it's this way, in such a way that I like your explanation, then I'll accept the way it is. But until you do that, I'm not going to accept it. And what I need to do is to accept it as it is, and decide to tell myself that that's the way it is because that's the way it is. And once I've accepted it and I move on, then a lot of times I'll understand why it was that way. It'll come to me intuitively, retrospectively, and I'll say, "Oh, that's why that was," when I no longer care how we got to it. It impresses me that I haven't had a drink since I said... I accepted, really accepted my alcoholism. A mild case, but I accepted it. And I got it by mistake. I was never meant to be an alcoholic. My mother never suggested I be president of AA. No school counselor ever said, "But what about being an alcoholic? They have a lot of fun. You want to be an alcoholic?" Never occurred to me to be an alcoholic, and I got it by mistake. And but even so, once I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic, I haven't had a drink, and I had to do the steps, and I had to do this program in order to stay sober. And oddly enough, the things that I've had to do in order to stay sober have been the answer to every problem in my life since that time. And also, nobody has come to me with a problem such that the answer to their problem has not been in the steps. Isn't that a tremendous bonus? Tremendous bonus. All because I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. And it seems to me what happened was, when I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic, I accepted the challenge. I accepted the challenge of saying, okay, I'm an alcoholic. How do I live life successfully, completely, totally, in spite of that fact? And I think what happened is I moved from living in the problem to living in the answer. And I found the answer to life. Your life and mine. And I give out my phone. Max and I give out our phone number now. We live in the 714 area. The number is 240-3940, 240-3940. Get a lot of phone calls. And when people call, they will have a problem. And there's their voice, my voice, their problem, my program. Their problem doesn't have a chance. There's always an answer in the steps, in the program. That's a tremendous sense of security to have that. It's a tremendous gift, tremendous gift. No wonder I approve of being an alcoholic, for God's sake. It's a great way to go. I accepted it, and I went. Another thing I did, I went from being a whiner to being a winner. Because I always knew what my problems were, and who my problems were, and what they were doing to me, and what was wrong with Max, and what was wrong with our kids, and what was wrong with this, and my patients, and all that, and the things that made me drink. And today I'm a winner instead of a whiner. I went from being a victim. I was a victim of life. I was a victim of the sad, sad, sad life. I went from being victim to being the hero. Today, in fact, every one of us, life asks every one of us at every moment of every day, because your life is going to go on, which role do you want to play today? Do you want to be the victim or do you want to be the hero? Would you like to play a leadership role in your own life story? That's what life asks us. And we either whine through life or we're winners through life. And in fact, that's what's wrong with resentments, it seems to me. When I get a resentment, I go right over to the victim role, the whiner role. Somebody told me that resentment was the feeling I have when I think somebody else ought to feel guilty. And when they don't feel guilty, I have to whine louder. So, as a matter of fact, in moving from victim to hero, when I started taking leadership in my own life, when I gave up resentment, the opposite of resentment, the opposite of resentment is emotional independence. This afternoon, Max and Stacy at Al-Anon, they talked about emotional detachment. That's what they call it in Al-Anon a lot. And with Southern California, they call it release. If they're in a real nice mood, they call it release with love. But when you release the first few times, it feels like rejection, no matter what they call it. But to become emotionally independent of somebody else's life, to not have to pout or to not have to act a certain way to make them realize they made you feel bad so that they change their attitude, that's a cumbersome way to do it. Emotional pouting, we've gotten away from all of that. I just love being sober. I just love being sober. My only problem in all the world right at this exact moment is I can't think of how to end this talk. And it's getting so damn hot, we ought to all get out of here. I usually end it, Ted was saying, I love Rule 62. No, I do love 60. That's my license plate on my car. One car, the Cadillac, has 12 and 12. The other one was a little Opel GT. Now it's a Toyota. And the license plate is Rule 62, which is don't take yourself so damn serious. It's hard to have resentments and apply Rule 62. What I started to say was, he said, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. He said it was near the bottom of the page. That's wrong. We absolutely insist on life is in the middle of page 132. Very middle. I've counted it. There are 16 lines above it. yourself. I bet you go home and check it. There are 16 lines above it, 16 lines below it, and there are two extraneous words in front of it and two extraneous words after it, and in the very, 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 very middle, couldn't be any middler, of page 132, it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I think that was written by my higher power, because he likes that idea. I enjoy AA, and I enjoy being sober, and I'm proud. I can't say I'm proud to be an alcoholic. I don't know that I had anything to do with it. And so how could I be proud of it? I'm certainly not ashamed of it, but I can't be proud of it. You might say, well, I did have something to do with that. I drank too much. I think maybe I drank too much because I'm an alcoholic. I understand alcoholics have a tendency to do that. And so I'm neither proud nor ashamed to be an alcoholic, but I'm very proud, very proud. I'm very proud indeed. I think it's absolutely wonderful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's just terrific. I thank God for AA. I thank AA for my sobriety. And I thank you guys for having us here tonight. Thank you very much.